Our guest this hour is Ron Elving. Ron is the NPR News Senior Washington Editor, and he directs the coverage of the nation's capital and national politics and provides on-air political analysis for many NPR programs. He has Wisconsin ties. He served as a reporter and state capitol bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's a media fellow at Stanford University and the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He had those positions. And we have a lot to talk about this hour. We'll be, of course, talking about the fiscal cliff. What kinds of negotiations are going on? What would happen if they fail? Will they fail? What's the Republican stance on this? What's the president's stance on this? There is a report in the New Yorker that I saw this morning. Hillary Clinton is running for president, according to this article. And we will be talking about immigration reform, filibuster reform, because Ron covered the state capitol in Wisconsin. I would imagine he'll have a few things to say about Wisconsin as well. We always welcome your phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and that's about it. Hello, Ron. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. Good to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Well, let's start with, just because I read this this morning, and you may know more about this than I do, not that I want to talk about 4 years from now, but I feel compelled. The New Yorker has an article in this week's issue, evidently, saying that Hillary Clinton is running for president.
I don't think it's possible to talk about Hillary Clinton and not talk about the White House. She has been preparing to be the first woman president for decades, if you will. And now, of course, the prospect is out there in 2016 of there being another opportunity to be nominated by the Democratic Party. And she will almost surely, I think everyone in Washington expects, that she'll be a candidate for the Democratic nomination in 2016 as she was in 2008. Now, she would be, by the time she was taking office, just about the same age that Ronald Reagan was when he first became president, when he first took the oath of office. So that's probably going to be something of an issue in the campaign because, as we subsequently learned, Ronald Reagan, in his later years, at least as president, seemed at least to be suffering from some of the symptoms of the Alzheimer's that would eventually take his life. Not to suggest that Hillary Clinton is unwell. She seems to be extraordinarily healthy. She obviously has preternatural levels of energy.
Yes.
And she's been all over the world demonstrating that as Secretary of State. And her 4 years as Secretary of State have been, I think, generally speaking, acknowledged to have been highly successful. Not that everything about U.S. foreign policy has been, but that her particular performance has been highly successful. So all of that, in addition, of course, to her 8 years as First Lady and her time in the United States Senate and her extensive knowledge of the primary process, the nominating process, probably no one knows it better, all point to her having been exceptionally well prepared for this. And I think all that needs to happen now is she needs to finish her tour as Secretary of State. She needs to be replaced, which is something of a controversy here. And then also she has to decide exactly how she wants to go about announcing this. And to some degree, I think she would also like to be wooed. I think she would like to have people in the party kind of come to her and say, it is definitely your turn, Hillary Clinton. We would like you to be our nominee.
What does she have to do the next 4 years to put her in the best position to run? What kind of job will she have?
She will probably just be running for president, as has proven to be the best way to get the nomination, is to be solely focused and wholly focused on just that one task. Go to Iowa, go to New Hampshire, go back to Iowa, go back to New Hampshire, go to a few of the other states that are going to matter, and of course go absolutely relentlessly to the sources of money in the Democratic Party. That's Los Angeles, San Francisco, other big cities on the West Coast, and New York City, and any big city in America where you can gather a sizable number of people of means and ask them to back your campaign to the maximum.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about Susan Rice. Is this possible nomination going nowhere at this point?
There is every chance, I believe, that President Obama will nominate Susan Rice to replace Hillary Clinton. Now, that may surprise a lot of people because Susan Rice has been far from a household name. And some of the other names that have been mentioned, such as John Kerry, the senator from Massachusetts who ran for president in 2004, or Chuck Hagel, former senator from Nebraska, a Republican, very popular in the Senate, very popular, well thought of in Washington. People like that would have no trouble at all getting nominated, whereas Susan Rice has become something of a symbol accountable to the Republicans in Congress and to Republicans in general because of her, to some degree because of her performance as United Nations ambassador, which they've had some problems with, and because she hasn't necessarily been very cuddly with the Republicans over the 4 years she's been here. But really, she has become the symbol for the Republicans and conservatives in general objection to the way the Obama administration handled the attack on our Benghazi mission on September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
She went on a series of television shows that following Sunday, and she gave the administration line. And the administration line was that, among other things, the attack on the consulate in Benghazi was motivated by people who were angered by an anti-Muslim video, which was apparently what was angering some people at some demonstrations in many parts of the Arab world that week, including Egypt. And that was a real factor for many of those people. But what went on in Benghazi that took the lives of several Americans, including our ambassador to Libya, that was something quite different. And as we have subsequently learned, it was an attack planned by terrorists who have some connections to Al-Qaeda. But Susan Rice was not acknowledging that. In September, she was talking these talking points about spontaneous demonstrations. And there's some indication that as UN ambassador, with her highest level of clearance, she had already learned from the CIA that there was a lot more to this thing that happened in Benghazi than just a spontaneous demonstration about a video. And yet she gave the impression that the video was really the main culprit here. So that has been viewed as an attempt by the Obama administration to sidestep the presence of Al-Qaeda in Libya, to stick to their administration line, which is that Al-Qaeda has been defeated and essentially rendered ineffective by the death not only of Osama bin Laden, but of other Al-Qaeda leaders. So all of that is a little, maybe just a little bit of a struggle between the parties, a little bit of an ideological struggle, a little bit of a election year fight. But there are real issues there, and the Republicans are showing every sign that they're going to resist her nomination and possibly defeat it or filibuster it so that they don't have to defeat it and actually vote against her.
And why wasn't it the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton who was on those Sunday morning talk shows about Benghazi?
Well, that is an excellent question. I think probably the main reason was that the administration wanted someone that they were quite certain that they could count on to give the exact talking points and not go beyond that. Also, it is entirely possible that Hillary Clinton was not that excited. And I do not know this for a fact, but I would speculate that she was not that excited about going out and getting herself too closely associated with what had gone on in Benghazi. Now, of course, she's the Secretary of State, so these are her employees
right.
in the main, and you know, Chris Stevens, the ambassador, worked for her. But she may very well have been at that particular time, as I recall, she was out of the country. She was traveling in her job as Secretary of State, and she had a lot of high-level negotiations going on, and she had other things to do besides go on three or four or five talk shows on Sunday morning, which sometimes may seem to be the main job of some of the people associated with the White House. Tim Geithner did the same thing yesterday as Treasury Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And she may just have been out of pocket, not really available for that, and she may have had reasons for not really wanting it to be her. And let's also throw in, if the administration was thinking about Susan Rice as the next Secretary of State, this was a chance to put her out there on the firing line and see how she did.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about money. We had this big election, and it would appear from polls that most Americans, well over 50%, would like for those who are very wealthy among us to pay more in taxes. Will indeed that wind up happening or not?
I believe it will. I believe that people with incomes over $250,000 will see higher taxes. Now, whether that takes the form of higher tax rates on the amount they make in excess of $250,000, or whether the final number will be $250,000 as the cutoff, or whether it will be considerably higher, we just don't know at this point, and neither does anyone else. This is a negotiation that's underway, and we don't know whether it'll be higher tax rates or whether it will be the elimination of some of the deduction exemption effect that is felt on people's tax returns when they itemize. When they have a large income, sometimes their deductions can get quite large. So, for example, if you've got a home mortgage and you live in a state with a high income tax and you have some other deductions, perhaps for health expenses and what have you, you can get over $50,000. Some people have have over $100,000 in deductions. If we were to cap those deductions at some lower figure, 50, 30, 25, it would make a great deal of difference in terms of how much taxation people with a lot of money wind up facing. So that's another way to skin the cat. But these negotiations are, depending on whom you talk to, either quite in the beginning phase, they're just sort of sizing each other up, or they're just basically broken down and in stalemate. Either way, we're a long way from an agreement, I think, at this point, and it's probably going to have to get right up to the deadline of January 1st, or we may actually have to go past January 1st and have some of the consequences as a result.
And, Ron, would the administration rather just raise the top tax rate beyond its current 35%? Is that preferable? And if so, why would that be the way they want to go?
That's the way they want to go because, number one, it's the simplest thing. I mean, you go from 35 to 39.6, which is what they're proposing, which really is just returning it to the rate that it was at during the Clinton years, which were pretty good years for the economy and very good years for the revenue flow for the United States government. And they would just like to take that top rate back up to nearly 40%. And notice that it's 39.6. That's a little bit like the gasoline prices
right.
that always have a 9.
Yes.
You know, making it look like a bargain. But basically to 40%. Now, that's not on all the income of the people who pay that rate. It's just on their income in excess of a certain number. In the proposal of the administration, that would be $250,000 a year for a couple, $200,000 a year for an individual. And they like that because it's a straight shot. You know how much money you're going to get. You know how many people are going to be subjected to that rate, and you have some idea of how much income they're going to have. So it's something you can count on, and it's also something that has been campaigned on, vetted, if you will, with the American people, and approved of, as you said, by a majority of the country as a whole, and by an overwhelming majority of Democrats. So that's why they would prefer to do that. There are some other reasons, too, though. I mean, deductions hit states inequitably in the sense that if you have a state with a state income tax, sales tax, and a lot of expensive real estate, you know, think about the East Coast states, think about California, to some degree, state of Washington, a lot of real estate there has appreciated hugely over the years, and people have mortgages of $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 who are not terribly wealthy. They may have a mortgage that is most of the value of a home that is barely adequate to house their family. That's quite common in California and on the East Coast. So you'd be catching, via that deduction cap, many middle-class people who are not really the top rung of middle class and not terribly affluent and certainly not, by most people's standards, rich.
Republicans would like, of course, cuts and probably major cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. What are they suggesting right now, and what do you think the administration would be willing to agree to?
Well, all the Republicans have really done that's different from what we've seen in recent years is John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, has said that he and the Republican Party are willing to talk about revenues, which means letting the government take in more money. They would prefer some kind of deduction cap. They would prefer some sort of tax reform, as they call it, which would be going back into the code and trying to broaden the base and lower the rates, in fact. Certainly lower the rates on businesses, corporations, and the president is also in favor of doing that. But trying to create jobs by eliminating deductions and loopholes and keeping the rates lower, making them lower. That is a little bit different from the position that Republicans have had in recent years, which was simply no more revenues, no more taxes, you know, keep everything the way it is. And basically that means that Bush tax cuts that were passed 2001-2003 under the second President Bush and George W. Bush, with a lot of Democrats voting for them and being glad to cut taxes back when we had something close to a balanced budget or even a little surplus. And at the time that they passed those cuts in 01 and 03, they sunsetted them, like 10 years. And now we're coming to the end of the deadline. It's been extended a couple of times in the case of some of these taxes. And we're coming to the end of that. And now it's time to decide whether we want to make those lower rates. And they may not seem lower because they're the current rates, but whether or not we want to make the rates that were lowered in 2001 and 2003 permanent. The president has proposed making them permanent for 98% of the taxpayers, everybody up to 250, but letting them lapse, letting them go back to the Clinton-era rates for that top 2%.
Ron Elving is our guest for All Things Political this hour, senior Washington editor for NPR News. And we're welcoming phone calls. We'll go to your calls in just a moment here. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Care to use an email? You can do that. talk@wpr.org. Or you can always go to our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, David K. Johnston will join us, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, and we'll be looking extensively at our current tax code, at Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and the debt. Two phone calls now for Ron. Let's start with Ruth in Madison. Hi, Ruth.
Well, thank you. I was wondering why the Democrats don't do a better job of public relations on some of these issues. For example, on these tax changes that they're talking about, why doesn't President Obama say things like, what we're doing here is we're ending the failed tax hikes or the failed tax cuts, where tax cuts under Reagan were given to the wealthiest people, and these tax cuts were extended under Bush. And all those years, jobs have hemorrhaged out of the country. Obviously, they're not creating jobs, so we're ending the tax cuts that have failed. And, or for example, when they're asking him about the tax on the embassy, why doesn't he say, I'm asking Congress for funding for a commission to study a tax on our embassy? This one and the 11 or 13, however many, were under George Bush that nobody cared about.
Ron.
The president has said some of those things, and some of the other Democrats have also made those representations and had that message at various times during the last few months. But they don't sell it nearly as well as the Republicans have sold the idea that any time the government's talking about higher revenues or higher taxes, it's going to be paid by you, no matter who you are, even if you do not make $250,000 a year, even if you don't make anywhere near that, you will somehow be caught up in any federal tax increase. And that is an easy thing to sell because people basically believe that. People don't know, for example, that the payroll tax cuts of the last 4 years were a fairly substantial tax cut that they themselves benefited from. Most people, if you ask them, did taxes go up or down in the first 4 years that President Obama was president, will say up, or they'll say they stayed the same. They are not aware of the degree to which taxes were cut. The stimulus back in 2009 was primarily spending, but about a third of it was tax cuts, and it went directly to people in the form of lower payroll taxes. So if you work for a living and you got a paycheck, you were taking home more cash. Many people didn't notice that, or if they noticed it, they didn't attribute it to the stimulus package from the Obama administration. So, yes, they have tried to get some attention for these things. They have tried to make the if you will, sort of populist appeal of saying we're only trying to tax people who really should be able to give more. The president has many times said people like himself, people who have millions of dollars, people who make big six-figure incomes every year. He includes himself. He includes other wealthy people that he knows and sometimes shares a stage with. You know, he'll say to Mitt Romney, for example, Mitt, you and I can afford to pay a little more. That's what I'm trying to do, get more money from the most affluent. But unfortunately, from the standpoint of the Democrats, and I suspect the caller from Madison, is the Democrats have not persuaded people that they're only focusing on these well-off people. The general impression is that if taxes go up, everyone's paying more taxes.
Do you imagine in tone, in policies, we will see a different president this 4 years, a more forceful president? He was accused of being, you know, a little bit trying to accommodate everybody, get everybody to like his policies and like him. Will there be a change in the next 4 years, do you think, Ron?
That change, I believe, has already begun, Kathleen. I think we're seeing a somewhat different Barack Obama on the Susan Rice issue. He appears to be pretty determined to go ahead and nominate her, despite the clear shots across the bow that he's received from Republicans in the Senate. And again, on these negotiations on the fiscal cliff, the president, rather than saying, well, okay, gosh, you know, the Republicans are willing to talk revenue. That's great. We're making some progress. He has said, that's not what we're talking about. Not just, quote, revenue. We're talking about higher tax rates on the affluent, and here's how much, and here's how much it's going to yield. And we're also ready to cut some spending. Here are our proposals. Where are yours? And that's a little more assertive, if not aggressive, on the part of the president than we saw 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, or for that matter in the summer of 2011 when we had the debt ceiling crisis that led to the downgrading of U.S. Credit worthiness. And the president was, I think, taken a little bit flat-footed by the Republicans' willingness to, or many of the Republicans, not certainly all, but many of the Republicans' willingness to flirt with an outright default on U.S. obligations. Some Republicans, Michelle Bachmann and other people who were quite prominent in the Republican Party, were saying, let's just go ahead and exceed the debt ceiling. I don't think that's really going to make any difference, and I don't think default really is a terrible thing. Let's just go ahead and do it. Pretty remarkable position for a major Republican Party's presidential candidates to be taking, but some of them actually were. So that, I think, took the Obama White House by surprise in 2011, as I think they had felt surprised by the rebuff they got from Republicans on health care back in 2009. They negotiated for months on a health care bill, and then after having changed it and changed it and changed it to try to get some Republican votes, the Republicans said across the board, with only one or two exceptions, but the ones they had been negotiating with across the board said, okay, we still oppose it. We still don't want Obamacare. We still don't want your plan, even though months had been spent trying to bring them on board and negotiate with them. So this is going to be a little different. He's not running for re-election again. He's had his last election campaign. He's ready now, I think, to stick to his guns in ways that we didn't see in the first term.
Charlie, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Fair and balanced as always.
Thanks for being with us, Charlie. Go right ahead.
My question is that, again, I find it interesting that Obama calls for rates of the Clinton era, but not Clinton spending limits. I feel that Washington has a spending problem and that the election was about raising taxes on the affluent as well as spending cuts. Why does it seem that the media is focusing on the Republicans as the bad boys in this situation when, in fact, it's both sides? Especially with the increase of government spending with Obamacare.
Thanks for the call, Charlie.
The Obamacare spending levels reflect, or at least as assessed by the Congressional Budget Office, a lot of adjustments to a lot of different other programs that are already existing and which might spend less money. And in the long run, according to the Congressional Budget Office, which is run by both parties, and the Republicans had control of both or had control of the House in the last 2 years, they say that Obamacare, as it is currently structured, with the participation of the states and so forth, would actually, over the 10-year period, save the federal government a little bit of money and would not represent a new level of spending. That is not the position of the Republican Party, and many conservatives feel that Obamacare is inevitably going to lead to higher spending. So that's one controversy. As far as the current situation that we're in, the Republicans have said we'll do revenues but not tax rate increases, and we want more spending cuts, but they haven't said what they would cut. That's what we're waiting to hear from Speaker Boehner or someone else. How do you want to cut Medicare? How do you want to cut Medicaid? Do you want to make adjustments to Social Security? The president wants to negotiate that separately off on another track. How do you want to cut other forms of federal spending? Because the biggest areas of federal spending are Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, the military, servicing the national debt. And if you start cutting into any of those things, you're going to have some political pushback. As for the whole rest of the government, you know, the FBI and the justice system and everything else the federal government does, discretionary domestic spending as a percentage of the total economy is lower now than at any time since the 1950s. So if you're looking there for cuts, it's not going to be enough to close the deficit gap.
Let's spend a few more moments on Obamacare. As you know, Wisconsin is one of the states that has said that we will not be setting up a state exchange. We will have the federal government come in. How many states are doing the same thing, Ron? And is the federal government ready to set up all of these exchanges that they will be in charge of? It's happening pretty soon, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And the deadline, in fact, has already been extended once for states to inform the government, the federal government, of what their plans are for setting up the exchange per state. Quite a few states in the South and some in the Midwest, some in the far West, most all of them with Republican governors, and 30 of the 50 states have Republican governors, right, as of this last election. They will have when they've all taken the oath of office. Most of the 30 states that have Republican governors are going to opt out of this thing, and they're going to say, we just don't want to set up this exchange. We don't want to take on the administrative responsibilities and costs, and we don't believe in it. We just don't think this is something the federal government ought to be making us do. And some of them also are going to opt out on some of the Medicaid cooperation that Obamacare would imply. So there is going to be a kind of war, not between the states, but between some of the states and Washington, D.C. And you've even heard a couple of states, talking about how this is a cause that would be so serious as to make them consider secession. Now, I don't expect this to be 1861 all over again, and no state is really seriously moving towards leaving the Union, but you do have states saying that they want to defy the federal government in the sense of Obamacare in any way they possibly can, and it's going to be a sizable number of states. Federal government is prepared to take the time to step in, to do the administrative work, to set up these exchanges, and one has to suspect that in the case of many of these states, perhaps including Wisconsin, Scott Walker, governor of Wisconsin, and some of the governors of some of these other states will wind up being less than happy with what the federal government sets up for them. And that's something that they're prepared to risk, I suppose.
Yeah. Pat in Brookfield, hi.
Hey, guys. A couple of things just struck me from this conversation. You know, first of all, since the moderator didn't want to, I'm going to have to go back and correct the revisionist history from one of the previous callers. Ronald Reagan cut tax rates. He was credited for one of the greatest economic expansions. And, you know, the comment she just made was somehow he caused a bunch of jobs to go overseas. That was caused over the last 30 years by something called the global economy, which is changing. But the point I wanted to make was we're having the wrong conversation here, and it seems to be that the media and the culture we live in, which liberalism permeates from academia, pop culture, much of the mainstream media, we're simply talking about tax revenue. And what people don't understand and fail to understand, and maybe they don't want to understand because they don't want to hear it, if we simply tax the rich, we're going to have extra $67 billion in revenue. And those facts and figures are not coming from me. They're coming from the Fiscal Bureau, pretty bipartisan numbers that everybody understands. My question to the speaker is, where on earth are we going to get the extra money to close these $1 trillion deficits that we're consistently running? And when we have a media, you know, if I look at turn to MSNBC, night after night after night, they attack any Democrat who says that we need to do anything about Medicare. They don't even want to face these problems, even suggest that they exist. And it's just, we're not even being honest with the American people. And, you know, we see the results we get in these different elections when people just think they simply have to tax the rich and they won't ever have to sacrifice on their own.
Ron.
The president's total package for trying to avoid the fiscal cliff and stop having these heart attacks over the debt ceiling and also reduce in the long term the federal budget deficit and bend the curve downward in terms of public indebtedness for the federal government includes about $1.6 trillion in tax increases that we have dwelt upon thus far. It's quite true. But the overall package is $4.4 billion. So the majority of it, the rest of $4.4 trillion beyond the $1.6 is spending cuts. Now, you can argue about how many of those spending cuts are brand new and how many of them were already in the pipeline. You can argue about whether or not the military should be included. It's hard to get very far without including the big, big tickets in the federal spending picture, and those are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the military. If you just look at domestic discretionary spending, the things that most people think of the federal government doing, including the functions of Congress and the president and all the cabinet and so on, the departments that we hear about, Department of Labor, Department of Commerce, all the rest of it, if you take all of that as a percentage of the total economy, that spending is at the lowest level it's been at since the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s. So you have to go at the real serious spending programs, and those are just a handful, but they're all very popular. People want a strong military. People want Medicare. People want Social Security. And while Medicaid is a little more controversial because that's for the poor, people want to have some means of dealing with the illnesses and the injuries of the poor, because otherwise they are in the emergency rooms raising everybody's health care costs.
Let's talk a little bit about voting. We're not that far from this major election. And there are a couple issues that remain on the table for many states. There are attempts to have vigorous voter ID laws, early voting, same-day registration here in the state of Wisconsin. Is this something that will work its way so it will be clearly defined by the Supreme Court, or will the Congress take up this issue? It seems to me as though it's only going to continue to be pretty divisive.
Yes, voting issues are particularly raw issues because people regard their right to vote as sacrosanct and constitutional, and they're quite right to do so. And people don't want to be turned away because of some sort of paperwork. But at the same time, there is a large body of belief among conservatives, among Republicans, that there is substantial vote fraud in America. Certainly in Wisconsin, the Republican Party has held for many years that there were fraudulent votes being cast, people voting multiple times, people voting with false identification, people voting who were not citizens, and that these votes were amounting to enough of a margin to elect the party that they favor. So if the presumption is that these people who are voting fraudulently are voting Democratic, that would be seen as one explanation for why Democrats won elections in Wisconsin. Now, the exact numbers of these things are very hard to pin down because we don't have a lot of prosecutable cases. In the state of Wisconsin in recent years, cases have been brought against a few people, but only a handful of people have been prosecuted because evidence could not be found for a larger number of cases. So this is the experience of many states. There's a strong body of belief that voter fraud is a big problem, but it's hard to bring the cases. It's hard to find the actual instances of it happening. In Florida, they searched the rolls, and they really did a scrub, and they found a few hundred people who looked like they were on the rolls illegally or looked to be fraudulent voters. And then when they got further down into it, it was fewer than even a few hundred in a state of many millions, the size of Florida. So it's been a struggle because of these very diametrically opposed notions. On the one hand, that this is about the ballot box's integrity and the integrity of our entire voting system, and that's the argument Republicans make. And on the other side, Democrats' belief that this is really all about making it more difficult for certain categories of people to vote, primarily people of color, older people, students, and most of those groups, not necessarily older people, but the other groups, vote Democratic in the main. So if those groups are, in some sense or another, discouraged from voting by the greater difficulties associated with greater voting integrity, as it's called, then that would supposedly hurt the Democrats. So it becomes not just a moral argument about honesty and integrity of voting, and not just a, gee, can we find the evidence to prove this is really going on argument. It also becomes another opportunity for the two parties to go at each other just for strictly partisan rivalry reasons.
What do you make of this interview with the former chair of the Florida Republican Party? It was published in a Florida newspaper last week, saying voter suppression was the sole reason for the change to election rules in Florida. Jim Greer, the guy's name is, he was the chair of the party from 2006 to 2010, said he went to several meetings during which Republican officials discussed the damage that early voting, which brought an unprecedented number of black voters to the polls in 2008, had done to the party.
Mr. Greer worked for the Florida Party during the governorship of Charlie Crist, who has since become an independent and really functionally a Democrat and may well run for office in Florida in the future as a Democrat. He was a moderate Republican. He was in good enough odor with his party in 2008 to be considered for vice president. But after that, when he embraced the Obama administration stimulus package in 2009, he became persona non grata and lost his bid to be nominated for the Senate. Now, Mr. Greer also has other elements of controversy in his background and has a lot of scores to settle with the Florida Republican Party. I doubt we're going to see very many people who were in those meetings come out and corroborate his version of what was said. But what he was saying was certainly music to the ears of many Democrats who, as I was saying earlier, have always felt that these efforts at ballot box integrity and eliminating voter fraud were largely about making it more difficult for certain categories of voters to vote. Many of those people vote Democratic.
Ron Elving is our guest this hour. He is senior Washington editor for NPR News, and we're welcoming phone calls for him as we talk about a variety of topics. He directs coverage of the nation's capital and national politics and provides on-air political analysis for many NPR programs. Our phone number here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we have a mini pledge drive coming up tomorrow. It's only going to be 4 hours long, and one of those hours will be this hour. So we're asking you to give now at WPR.org in support of shorter pledge drives. Tomorrow during this hour, we're going to talk about lots of people give gifts of books during this season, and we are going to talk about books, one of our favorite subjects. Daniel Golden will be joining us from Boswell Books, and we'll also be speaking with one of the authors of Read This, Handpicked Favorites from America's Indie Bookstores. So that's tomorrow at 9 o'clock. We hope you'll join us and give a gift to us, and we'll give you the gift of great reading for years to come. Back to phone calls for Ron Elving. Ann in Madison, hi.
Hi. First of all, with every school child learns that with rights come obligations, and it's really parasitic to refuse to accept any obligations to your fellow countrymen and countrywomen and just wallow in the rights and the privileges that you've managed to be given or acquire for yourself. But I really called about the FICA, the payroll tax, which was reduced by a third several years ago, I think under the Obama administration, and that, in the long run, that third reduction will definitely hurt Social Security because it will reduce it by a third from this point on. I think that really needs to be restored. And your guest said, was talking about Social Security. Social Security is paid for by employers and employees, you know, in equal amounts, and it's only managed by the federal government. It has not contributed a dime to the debt, and people who have to live on Social Security often have no other source of income. Do you want elderly people to die in the streets? I mean, I think to do anything to Social Security is absolutely outrageous. It's being misrepresented as contributing to our debt. You know, let's get out of these idiot wars and start demanding that people who are privileged pay their fair share of the nation's tax base.
Round. This is an exceptionally well-informed listener, Kathleen, that she knows about FICA, what it stands for, and the payroll tax. I had been referring to it earlier, just more popularly as the payroll tax. But this is the big cut that was made in the Obama administration to try to get more cash into people's pockets. And it wasn't really trumpeted very well. The media didn't really emphasize it in comparison to other elements of the stimulus package back in 2009. But it has been there. It has made some difference. It has put more cash in people's pockets and may have helped keep the recession from being any worse than it was and is, and perhaps help the recovery be a little bit stronger. Most people don't think of the recovery as being very strong. It's been a weak recovery, a sputtering recovery, but the payroll tax cut was one of the things the administration did to try to strengthen it. And she's quite right, too, that Social Security is not and should not be part of the current negotiation over the fiscal cliff. It has not contributed to the federal deficit. The question about Social Security is whether or not down the road, some years away, it will still be as solvent as it has been since 1935, and there will need to be some adjustments to the program, either in the sense of raising the eligibility age, which has been done before, or raising the payroll tax, which has been done before. And I suspect that the payroll tax cut that we saw in the last administration may be going away in the near future because Social Security needs to be fully funded. Now, most people don't know this, but there's a cutoff point at which you no longer pay the payroll tax on your income, neither you nor your employer. Or if you're self-employed, you don't have to pay both ends. After about $110,000, I think it is next year, $110,000 in Social Security exposed income. That could be lifted. It could be higher. It could be 150. It could be 175. There could be no limit at all. That would make the Social Security tax much more progressive than it's ever been. There's a whole argument to be made for and against that. But it is quite a separate discussion, as the caller said, from the rest of all these fiscal arrangements that we're talking about with this big deadline coming up at the end of the year, people call the fiscal cliff.
Thanks, Ian, so much for your call. I was thinking when you were talking earlier, Ron, about 30 of 50 states having Republican governors, and I was thinking also about the president was reelected a Democrat, and there are more Democrats in the Senate and in the House. How does that happen? And what kinds of problems does that mean we might be heading for in the next few years?
The reason we have so many Republican governors is most of them were elected in 2010. Actually, only a small handful of the governors are elected in the same year as the president. Most of them are elected in the two-year midterm election between presidential elections, and then there are a few scattered out in the odd-numbered years. We got a lot of Republican governors in 2010 because the country was in a very Republican mood in 2010. That's when, if you want to call it the Tea Party election, that's maybe a little too loose, but just as a sense of fixing it in time, this was the election when there was a lot of pushback from the 2006 and 2008 trends, pro-democratic trends of those years. And in 2010, we got a somewhat different-looking electorate, much more traditional. There were fewer young people. There were fewer people of color voting. And the strength of the more conservative coalition came out. And it came out in many states that had been voting Democratic in 06 and 08 and that went back and voted Democratic again in 2012. Take Ohio, for example. And to some degree, you could say Wisconsin, obviously, although Wisconsin also beat back the recall effort on Governor Walker in 2012. By the time we got to November, Wisconsin was back in kind of a Democratic mode and, electing Tammy Baldwin and reelecting President Obama, albeit with a smaller margin than he had in Wisconsin in 2008. So the pendulum swings in these things. And in 2010, when we had most of the nation's governors on the ballot, the pendulum was swinging to the right, and Republicans really cleaned house. We'll see what happens in 2014, but for the moment, we have a very heavily Republican set of governors. In fact, I believe this is the largest share of the total governor's picture that the Republicans have ever had.
Really?
They're going to be, I believe it is. I may be incorrect about that, but my recollection is that until the 60s and 70s, almost all the governors in the South from the well before the Civil War and straight on through, with the brief exception of Reconstruction, had Democratic governors. I mean, there was really only the Democratic Party in many, many states through that long period. Now those states are dominated by the Republican Party, still, if you will, a conservative domination, but it's switched party hats. I don't know if you've seen the movie Lincoln, but it confuses
people.
Yes,
I have.
it's a wonderful movie, and people
yes.
should all go see it. But one of the things about it that's a little confusing for a modern viewer is that at the time of President Lincoln's presidency, he and the abolitionists were all Republicans, and the people defending the rights of the Southern states to make up their own minds about things like slavery were all Democrats. That's a little different from the lineup that we have now, where the Southern conservative point of view is represented by Republicans from the South. But without getting into all of that history and all of the changeover that came in the 1960s and thereafter, we do have a very large number of very conservative governors right now who all call themselves Republicans, and therefore I believe this current 60% hegemony they have in the state houses is the strongest strictly for the Republican Party per se.
Given the emphasis placed on the Hispanic-Latino vote in the last election and the Republicans failing to capture a good chunk of that vote, do you see issues like immigration reform being possible issues where you can have bipartisan support for substantial legislation?
Yes. There will be some kind of revival of what we used to call the McCain bill, and there were various other people who co-sponsored it with him. But John McCain was very much a pro-immigration reform senator right up until he was running for re-election in 2010, and the sentiment was running against some of the immigration bills of that time in his home state. Actually, even in 2008, when he was the Republican presidential nominee, he had backed off his own legislation that had previously been the lead immigration reform legislation in the Senate and wasn't sure he would even vote for it anymore. That had a little bit more to do with the internal politics of the Republican Party nominating process, which have been pretty unfriendly to immigrants, particularly anyone in the country illegally, for an increasing proportions in recent years. So the big question next year is, if the president brings forth an immigration reform proposal that has a path to citizenship for people who are in the country illegally right now, will that have any chance of being seriously discussed in a Republican House of Representatives, and can it get through a filibuster in the Senate? Those are big questions. In the meantime, I suspect we'll take on a somewhat smaller issue, which is the DREAM Act, allowing children, who are now in the country and becoming adults reaching their age of maturity, but who were brought to this country by somebody else, brought to this country in many cases by their parents, and had nothing to say about the fact that they were breaking the law. They were just brought here with their parents illegally. So should those people be given a path to citizenship through education and service in the military if they have clean criminal records? That's what the DREAM Act would do. That act died this past year. In the end, it did not get the votes of all the Democrats, and it was badly beaten up among the Republicans in the Senate. So it has not gotten through in the first 4 years of the Obama administration. I suspect if you could get a clean vote on it in the weeks ahead, particularly when the new Congress has been seated in January, it would pass, and it would also get through the filibuster in the Senate as a first step towards allowing Republicans to talk to that Hispanic vote, which they were so badly beaten in 2012. I mean, they got less than 30% of the Hispanic vote. That's just not enough when you're talking about the fastest growing part of the nation's population.
Tom in Madison, hi.
Hi. My question about the spending cuts, is it actually cuts in spending, or is it a cuts in the proposed budget when they're talking about that?
Excuse me. Those would be cuts in the budget. Excuse me, Kathleen.
That's okay. Sure, yeah, that's fine. We'll give you a chance to get some water. It happens occasionally. We're going to continue. I just wanted to let you know there are a lot of financial questions, Social Security, taxes, et cetera, and we're going to get to all of you. We just are going to have another guest, but he'll be able to handle all of those at 10 o'clock. So don't be frustrated if you can just keep your messages. I'm aware of your messages, and if you can stay with us online, we'll be addressing those issues again at 10 o'clock. Are you okay, sir?
I think so, Kathleen.
Good. Yeah,
those are really cuts in budgeted amounts. They would not necessarily really reduce the amount of money the federal government has spent in the past. They would reduce the growth, and they would reduce new spending, and they would probably bend the curve of federal spending down in the longer run. But it doesn't mean we're going back to a dollar figure from 5, 10, 15 years ago.
Tom, thank you very much for the call. Let's go next to Dave. Dave is calling us from Eau Claire. Hello, Dave.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to point out that since the president and Harry Reid won in the Senate the election, they should really be leading the negotiation. And all we've really seen from them is political posturing to try to force the Republicans, who are in minority power, to try to lead the negotiations. And that's just wrong. The other point that I want to make, too, is that your analysis of Obamacare and the CBO, those were all made in 10-year projections from the time that the bill passed. And really, we should look at that bill from when it's fully enacted. And if you look at 2016 onward, when the entitlements are all enacted and the new tax increases are in effect, It truly is the biggest tax increase in history. And I think that you and the press should actually challenge the CBO to look at things. You wouldn't buy a home based on the budget on an ARM that had a lower interest rate than what the reality is. You'd purchase a home based on what your interest rates are going to be over a 30-year period when interest rates are truly fully in effect. And, I really think that your guest has been extremely biased in how he looks at things. I've been listening to him this hour. And it, again, shows why I don't listen to NPR very often.
Well, I'm glad you're listening today. And to defend our guest, I don't think he's been biased at all. He really knows what he's talking about. What about, well, we only have about 15 seconds. Should the president be leading negotiations more on these issues that he mentioned? Or not?
Well, the president has put forward his plan. Speaker Boehner represents the House of Representatives, where the Republicans are very much in the majority and are expected to remain so for some time to come. So, yes, anyone who has a majority to represent, anyone who has won an election, and certainly the House Republicans have won their elections, probably has the same responsibility to bring forth the specifics of what they would do to reduce the deficit. And, of course, both sides are trying to get the other side to own the unpleasant stuff. They want the president, and the president wants the Republicans, to own the unpleasant cuts, the painful cuts to Social Security, not Social Security, I should set that to one side, to Medicare, to Medicaid, to things that people care about, to the military. And those are the cuts that nobody really wants to put forward, but those are the only cuts that would be meaningful enough to really address the deficit.
Ron, thank you.
And the caller is also right about
it. We have to end at this point. We're out of time. But, Ron, thank you. It was a great hour. Join us again, please. Ron Elving, NPR News Senior Washington Editor. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. We have another hour coming up. Your calls will still be applicable here on the Ideas Network.